Welcome to Lena Live, hosted by Professor Lena Miermond and myself, Julian Lampert. Today, we have our final segment, part 4, devoted to Calvary Hospital, one of the gracious supporters of our program. We have as our guest Dr. Sherry Schachter, who directs the hospital's bereavement services. We'll listen to Dr. Schachter talk about how the hospital treats the terminally ill patient's family, and this is central to Calvary Hospital's philosophy, which is about not only treating the terminally ill patient, but about indeed the entire family unit. Let's listen to Dr. Schachter speak.
So my name is Sherry Schachter, and I've been doing this work for about 37 years. I know I don't look old enough. I can talk forever on bereavement. It's an area that has been my focus for 37 years. Started out as a nurse, worked for 23 years at Sloan Kettering, and then when that job became more administrative and took me away from patients, I went back for my master's and my doctorate, stayed at the hospital, but became an attending grief therapist there, and then left Memorial in 2005 and came here to Calvary, which I absolutely love. I feel like I've come home. I was born and raised in the Bronx, so this is home to me. I've always known Calvary from the time I was growing up and had great respect for the work that was done here. And for anyone that does bereavement work, Calvary is such a magnificent place to work. On several levels. Number one, because we have so many deaths a year, both here in the hospital as well as with our home hospice program. But also, it's the mission of the hospital, is taking care of families after the death, so that it's an ideal place to work for bereavement. So I've been here since 2005. I also do a little bit of teaching. I'm an adjunct professor at the College of New Rochelle in their graduate program. Mm-hmm. So I teach about bereavement. I teach about end-of-life care. Also courses of psychology and human growth and development, group counseling, group theory. And I have a very, very, very small private practice in Manhattan because I'm like all over the place. I live in Pennsylvania, so I'm all over.
In Pennsylvania? I'm stunned.
Yeah, I know. Been doing it for about 24, 25 years now, going back and forth. During the week, I do stay in my office in Manhattan, although my husband goes back and forth pretty much on a daily basis. I'm here during the week. I tend not to work at the hospital on Fridays. I work out of the house on Fridays. So I go home Thursday night and then come back Monday morning about, 5 in the morning to get the started.
But your mind is working all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
That's
what keeps me young. Absolutely.
We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services at Calvary Hospital here in New York City. Dr. Schachter, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Can you tell us the history of the Bereavement Center and how did it come about at Calvary?
Bereavement has always been a large part of what the hospital's mission has been. We feel very strongly about not abandoning our families after the patient dies. And so way before I came to the hospital in 2005, there's always been an aspect of a bereavement program. The major change has been when I came in, as I said, 2005, I brought with me a theoretical research-based program that is specific for the work that we do. The interventions are therapeutic. I know that they're therapeutic because they're evidence-based research, which is a very important aspect. And many programs are not theoretically based. Many programs are more peer-oriented or supported by volunteers and not individuals that are trained to do bereavement therapy or trauma therapy, which is different from bereavement therapy.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of what a theory-based
Absolutely.
Therapy would be,
Absolutely.
As opposed to what you were saying
okay.
that is pure?
So there are groups that are led by individuals that perhaps have had a significant loss, and so they will lead a group, a bereavement group. And sometimes these groups go on forever, for years. They can be an open group, so people kind of come and go, and in fact do stay in the group for a very long period of time because they feel comfortable in the group, mm-hmm. they get familiar with the group, and then it becomes more social. Mm-hmm. That's not theoretically based, because then you don't want people to become dependent on the group. We want them to be able to, after a significant loss, to go on with their lives mm-hmm. and continue on with their lives and not be tied to whether it's the hospital that cared for their loved one or any other bereavement support. So a good example of a theoretical-based approach would be, over the past maybe 10, 15 years, research has been done in the field of thanatology, and thanatology is the study of death and dying. Research has been done showing that the way that people grieve varies, very, very different. We don't grieve in the same way, but there is a process that people go through in their grief that they can relate to one another. There's some consistency there. And where years ago the belief was, well, we don't tell children about death because they're too young, they won't understand, they don't need to go to the funeral or a shiver or a wake. When they're older, we'll explain. That was the theory when I was growing up. Not the theory, but that was the belief when I was growing up. Now we have theories such as the continuing bond theory, which says we continue our bonds with our loved one once they're deceased, obviously in a different way, but we continue, whether it's through memorialization, through rituals, going to the cemetery, perhaps during holiday time, keeping rituals, creating new rituals. Another theory, more recent, comes out of the work of Strobe and Schut, which are my colleagues in the Netherlands. And they have come up with what they call the dual process. The dual process theory says that individuals can't spend all day grieving. They oscillate back and forth. So, for example, a woman that loses her husband, maybe they were married 50, 60 years, she now has to learn how to manage the checkbook or how to manage stocks and bonds or finances, if that was not her area of expertise. So she'll go in and out. She'll grieve for a while, but then she'll focus on tasks that help her to grieve but also educate her. And similarly, it works the same way for men. You know, he may have to learn how to take care of young children if he's left with a four-year-old at home after his wife dies. So that's the dual process, so where individuals go back and forth. When we work with our bereaved family members, and Calvary's open to the community, it's not just our families. All of our services are free, and all of our services are open to the community. I never say to a group member, this is the dual process, or this is Bill Warden's tasks of mourning. In my mind, that's how I frame the work that we do. So I don't, the individuals coming to the group don't get that educational piece unless they ask a question. And sometimes it does come up. Sometimes we do, especially when we talk about young children and how children grieve, we do try and educate individuals. So we do talk about theories and what we've learned over the past 50 years or so. But for the most part, those theories guide our interventions and make our groups therapeutic, but yet they're not in your face, this is the theory.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services at Calvary Hospital here in New York City. One important element here that we're
conveying is through our program is that Calvary is not just about taking drastic measures to treat someone who is terminally ill, that it's an institution that is caring for the entire family unit. And this is something that we are very much intent on conveying, as much as Calvary's medical role in the fate, in the outcome of a patient. In terms of children and adults and how they grieve differently, we'd love to hear what you have to say about that. And one of the questions that I have about that is it as obviously different as they are? Are there, in fact, any similarities between how children and adults grieve that perhaps we're not aware of, but might be important in looking at how they both grieve, or not?
There are similarities. There are more differences than there are similarities. There are also important factors to consider, especially when talking about children, because children don't exist by themselves. They exist in a family structure, whatever that family is, whether their aunt is raising them or a grandparent or they're in foster care, whatever their family, that family structure is, that will impact the child and the way the child grieves. Religious beliefs, cultural beliefs, very important to consider, because we as adults role model for children how to express your grief and what is acceptable or not. And so the family unit is very important in the way that children grieve. And recent research coming out of the University of Arizona, a colleague, Dr. Erwin Sandler, as well as other people, have talked about the importance of good parenting. Not necessarily meaning a parent, because it could be any guardian raising that child, but to use the term good parenting. Because if a parent is doing well, then the child will do well. If a parent is so engulfed in their grief and perhaps has a clinical depression, that will impact on the way the child grieves. So parenting skills for parents or guardians, very important in working with children. You're not working in isolation, even with teenagers, but young children as well. Fascinating, I was at a conference last week, a whole week, from ADEC, which is the Association for Deaf Education and Counseling. Mm-hmm. And I attended a workshop, which was fascinating, on grieving infants. We start our children's group at ages 6, but children, even young children, 2, 3, 4 years old, grieve. I had never really thought about it, and I'm not that well steeped and educated, but this was a fascinating conference showing videotapes of how infants grieve, how their body language, obviously they don't have the words, they don't know that their mother has died or their father has died, but the anxiety that they display, feeling abandoned, is absolutely amazing. Mm. So there's research, more and more research, about the differences in the ways that infants, young children, and teenagers grieve. For young children, it's interesting because they don't have the words, and so most of what we do with them is through expressive art therapy. A lot of art, creative, whether it's puppets, clay, painting, ways for them to express themselves, because they don't have the words. What's interesting in a major difference in between the way children and teenagers and adults grieve is that when we grieve, we can grieve. We could probably cry all day long, especially initially. And then over time, that lessens. We never forget our loved ones, never, ever. But the intensity of that grief changes. So if we lose our father, for example, and we're 40 years old, we will grieve for him the rest of our lives. But the intensity changes. It may spike up again around holidays. We just passed Easter, Passover. Any major holiday will bring back the way it was when we were growing up. Children will not sit and cry all day long. They can't. So they'll cry or be upset for a little bit. Then they'll go inside and watch television. Then they'll go cry or ask questions. Then they'll go out and play with their friends. And so years ago, we used to think, oh, they don't understand, or they've gotten over it. It's not that they've gotten over it. It's that they don't have the capacity to sit there and feel that heaviness, because they don't have the words to describe the heaviness as well, mm-hmm. which is why it's important for the adults around them to role model. It's okay to be angry. When I'm angry, I punch a punching bag or I punch the pillow. I never punch anyone else because that's not healthy or good. When I'm sad, I can cry. It's okay to cry. It's okay not to cry, but to role model. The other major difference is if a young child loses a parent or a parental figure, that child grieves throughout their entire life in a different way. So for a boy, for example, when he gets his driver's license, he'll grieve the loss of his dad. A girl, maybe for her, even if her mom died when she was 8 years old, when she's 16 and she goes to her first prom, she'll grieve, her mom's not there. When she gets married, she'll grieve the loss of her father, not being able to walk her down the aisle. When she has a child, she'll grieve the loss of her mother. Her mother's not there. So the grief is very different when a child loses a parental figure. Their whole life, and as they get older, they also have a different understanding of the death. So our groups, for example, at Calvary, our children's groups, as all our groups, are free, open to the community. Most of the children and teens that come to our groups are not Calvary family members. These are people from the community. So we see a lot of trauma. Suicides, drug overdose, shooting, knifing, a lot of trauma from the community where we, unfortunately, from where we live. That's the reality. When a child's father is murdered and they're 8 years old, they have a very different understanding than when they get to be a teenager. So they'll re-grieve that loss as they get more information. Mm-hmm. I saw someone just recently, an adult, who was coming into one of our adult groups, and she told me, almost as a passing, by the way, as she was leaving the office, her mom died when she was in her first year of college, and she was told that her mom had a heart attack. It wasn't until she was in her 40s that she learned her mom had suicided. Oh. So she is now re-grieving in a very different way the loss of all of these years. Yeah. This is obviously an adult woman in her 50s now who is trying to come to terms with the suicide of her mom. So children will grieve their lifetime in different ways, different than the ways that adults grieve.
Let's take a short break for a word from one of our supporters, Calvary Hospital.
Dear Calvary Hospital, James Lee was a true hero. Saving lives was something he always wanted to do, whether as a paratrooper for the 82nd Airborne or as a New York City fireman. They called him Jimmy. I was proud to call him Dad. But when terminal illness ravaged his body, this man's man knew that this was one life that could not be saved, not even by me, an experienced nurse. It just wasn't fair that he had to suffer like this. But then Calvary stepped in. You relieved his enormous pain and not only gave him the peace and comfort he deserved, but you also gave me and my family a chance to enjoy his final days, smiling and laughing, together one last time. How can we ever forget what you mean to us? Yours truly, Colleen Lee.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital, where life continues. Call us at 718-518-2000. Thank you.
We're back with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services at Calvary Hospital, who joins us for this final segment devoted to Calvary Hospital, one of the supporters of our program.
You remind me of one experience I had. I was belonging to, it's called Family Circle. Probably one of the most profound experience I've had, because I just learned the depth and endless capacity of grief, because the children who would come there with such a grief that adult would not be able to handle. And I will interrupt myself with my little story, but to commend you, because what I hear, that somehow with your expertise and your intuition, you're able to connect a micro-level approach to tiny little soul which is exposed to such a huge, overwhelmed challenge. So I see that Calvary offers what you said to the community. That's really the sound that you're offering this to the community, which has all these tremendously sharp corners. And one easily can be overwhelmed in your position, but not only you are not, but you bring science to it and merging this with a practical thing, which I think very, very unique. Don't know how many more institutions have this, so I just wanted to commend you for this. And since we're only on the radio, I see your wonderful smile. I wanted to make sure that all our listeners are feeling that smile.
Thank you. It is, Calvary is unique. Most hospitals, if they offer a bereavement program, have a very limited bereavement program. They don't see that as part of their mission. That's not part of the mission of most hospitals. In addition to which, it's very expensive to run a bereavement program, a large bereavement program. And we don't charge here at Calvary. There's no charge. So even our summer camp, we have a summer camp. When I first came, I think we had 17 children, bereaved children, come to the camp. Last year, we had 86 children, and this year I know we're going to go over 100. Mm. These are children that have been bereaved, obviously. They come to our camp, Camp Compass. It's a 1 week day camp, and the week is spent, half the day is spent with fun activities as you would expect in camp, you know, basketball, swimming, hiking, all the fun activities. The other half of the day is spent doing bereavement activities. So every camper gets a backpack, shirts, a baseball cap, and a sweatshirt. We serve two meals a day, two hot meals a day, breakfast and lunch, with enough food that they take home in Tupperware. No, well, not Tupperware, but the disposable leftovers.
Containers. Yeah.
The disposable containers, so that they have for dinner as well. Mm. And camp gives the children an opportunity, a true opportunity, to know that it's okay to laugh as well as to cry. So we have clowns from the Big Apple Circus that come every day, just doing their antics and fun things with the kids. And they do face painting and things like that. So it really is, the children really get the sense that it's okay. I can laugh. I'm not being disrespectful. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I'm forgetting. It doesn't mean that I didn't care about my mom or my grandmother. So camp is very, very important.
I made previously comments, and I'd like to make this one again. You are such a tremendous anchor for the schools, needless to say, because the school is almost like a second family becomes. But I think sometimes you're becoming a first family who really helping those teachers who obviously cannot even conceive to be of help, which you're providing.
That leads me to tell you something else. We're very excited in our groups are here at Calvary Hospital, but we also do groups both for children and adults in downtown Brooklyn. And the groups are held at St. Joseph's High School. And I actually have two of my Brooklyn counselors have their offices at St. Joseph's High School. And it's been a wonderful experience doing the groups there. And just recently, we've been asked to do a pilot program in one of the groups, high schools in Brooklyn, where they have a very large number of bereaved children. And perhaps not as much family or parental involvement as we would like to see with our teenagers. And so we've been asked to do the school, to actually go to their school and do groups during the school day at their school. We'll be starting that, which is exciting. Mm. We also have pet therapy we started this year. This is very exciting because I love dogs. This is very exciting. We know that animals are very therapeutic, and dogs in particular, they're so calming. And there's been much research, not just with bereavement, but with cardiac patients and cancer patients, nursing home individuals residing in nursing homes, the importance of pet therapy. So we have at camp one day a week a dog that comes, a pet therapy dog. And we decided, well, this is something we should be doing in our groups all year round, not just at camp. So we just started, I guess it's about 4 months ago, 3 or 4 months ago, having pet therapy to all the Brooklyn groups, both the children's groups, Precious Moments, are ages 6 to 11, and then the teenage groups. And we also started it not every day. The dogs come every day for the kids. But in the adult groups, once every couple of weeks, we have pet therapy for the adults. So that's a something new that we've added just recently.
Hmm. Congratulations with that.
Thank you.
It has tremendous future in its own.
We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services here at Calvary Hospital in New York City. In terms of bereavement services at the hospital, how do you determine who is grouped into which category? So that obviously taking into account the different ways that people grieve.
Very good question. Because sometimes in the community bereavement groups, everyone is lumped together. And you may have someone who had a death 5 years ago with someone that had a death 2 months ago. So it really is...
I'm just hearing some.
We're hearing your work.
Yes.
That's what we hear.
That's the 6 to 11 year olds.
Yeah.
You want to tell them to?
Okay.
So everyone that calls looking for a group, and we get numerous calls from schools, from teachers, social workers, hospitals in the community that don't offer bereavement services, ACS, foster care, many avenues. And families themselves can call, say, I'm looking for, you know, I know that Calvary has bereavement services. Do you have a group? So we always do an intake, a face-to-face intake, because you can't get information over the phone. You need to see someone's face to see if they're ready for a group, if they're able to talk about their loss. It also helps me to put people in particular groups. So, for example, our groups are very separate. We don't have general mixed groups. We have groups for parents who've lost adult children, groups for individuals who've lost their spouse or partner, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, as long as it's a sexual relationship, that's another group. We have groups for adults who lose parents, adults who lose a sibling, And then we have the kids groups. We also have, actually, our one mixed group is our Spanish-speaking group. So we have a Spanish-speaking group that has different kinds of losses, but obviously all done in Spanish. And we have a men's group as well. So, for example, in our spouse/partner group, we have five groups a week. So when I do an individual intake, I can see this person would be good for this group, or this person, I think they would connect with the individual in this group. So we always do an intake. We say for the adult groups, it has to be a recent loss. Some recent as defined, someone within the first 18 months. Now that doesn't mean that someone who's had a death 3 years ago is completed finishing and they're fine and they're ready to move on. However, they're in a different place than someone who just had a death 6 months ago. They've already had, you know, 3 years of Mother's Days or anniversaries or birthdays. For someone who's newly bereaved, this is their first time. So we say it has to be an individual who's had a loss within the first 18 months. When I see someone and I feel they still may need some help, even though it's past the 18 months, I will refer them into the community, wherever they live, whatever that community is. That's another large aspect of what we do, is being able to refer people in their communities if it's too far from Calvary or it's past the 18 months. For children, it's different, because with children, they regrieve, as I mentioned, they regrieve the loss over years. So I may have a child come to the group when they're 8 years old. They may graduate out of the group when they're 9 and a half, 10 years old. And all of a sudden, they hit their teenage years and they say, They start asking more family questions, get more information, and perhaps need more help in regrieving the loss, especially if it was a traumatic loss or a homicide or a drug overdose that might have been self-inflicted, like a suicide. So they may need to regrieve. So the stringency for children is very different than with adults. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely, yes.
I should also mention, when I'm thinking of numbers, that in our camp, we maintain a 2-to-1 ratio, which I am very proud of. Yeah. So each counselor gets no more than 2 children. So these children get special attention. They are really bonded and tied to their counselor for the week. And there are about 15 counselors that don't take an assignment. So, for example, myself, my counselors are junior counselors who are individuals that have gone through the program now in college. They come and they mentor and help with the younger children. They don't take an assignment. So there's about 15 that don't take an assignment.
We just reinforced one thought I had, that in time, there's so much problems we have, and obviously the criticism we just mentioned of certain challenges in education and, of course, family disintegration, all these elements. We have to prioritize sometimes things differently in our times. And you're dealing with the extreme end of tragedies. And I believe that this is just extraordinary that you can, and that you are attaching not more than 2 children to 1 individual. So I believe perhaps stretching, saying that besides just getting this incredible help, support in the most crying times, you're really creating a foundation for life, which sometimes even a little bit more important than knowledge of first or second or elementary school knowledge, because you create that foundation in the brain, the life. So I have to reemphasize that this is very, very rare when in today's extremely hectic society, when classes is absolutely overfilled and community colleges, certainly grabbing tremendous amount of information, but that very human element is often missing. And you're giving this in the most incredibly challenging times when it's greatly needed, creating, as I said, the whole spectrum of seeing the life in the future. That's absolutely tremendous uniqueness.
Thank you. I think so. It's amazing work. It's very gratifying work. It really is. Sometimes people say, you know, don't you get depressed? You know, you've been doing this for about 37 years.
Yeah.
And I say, do I look depressed? I don't. I get so much and have gotten so much from the families that I've worked with over the years, both before the patient has died and then working with families afterwards. It's very gratifying, and it's always given for me a way to prioritize the raising of my family, of what's important in life, what's worth arguing over, and what's worth saying, you know, there are more important things. So it has been not only a foundation, I believe, for the children that we work with, but I think for the counselors as well. It really grounds us and shows us what is important in life and how we treat one another and how we should care for one another,
yes,
especially at the end of life.
And every doll has this little children or child inside. And I would not even find a word when I felt loss of my mother. It was differently from losing my mother and losing my father. But suddenly I felt as a little girl. So I probably would benefit from one of your groups as a little girl. But well spoken. We learn so much ourselves going through that.
In terms of different faiths, different religions, of course, Calvary is officially a Roman Catholic institution, but embraces all faiths. Could you talk a little bit about how you bring that into consideration when you're dealing with bereavement?
Absolutely. Another good question. Because Calvary is in New York City, we have families of all different faiths and non-religious as well. My experience has been, and the research shows it, backs it up as well, oftentimes after a death, children as well as adults are very angry at God, no matter what their religious beliefs are. How could God have done this? You know, my grandma was such a good person. Or how could this happen? My husband, you know, left me with a six-month-old child that now I have to raise. You know, it's not fair. There's no anger directed at God we see early on. And I've always told people, if it tends to be, if you were religious before, you'll eventually get back to your belief system. But it's very frightening for individuals because now they're afraid that God's going to punish them because they're angry at God. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a domino effect. We don't introduce faith into our groups. Our groups are not faith-based at all. If a child or an adult brings up religion, we certainly address it and discuss it. But because each family has their own belief system. So with children, for example, you may have families that tell children about their grandmas in heaven, but you may have other families that never use that terminology, or you may have families that don't talk about it at all. So our practice has been, since I've come to Calvary, is not to use any of our exercises or bereavement programs or activities. None of them are faith-based. They're spiritual. We talk a lot about nature, but they're not faith-based. So that people of all religions, as I say, or agnostics or atheists, feel comfortable coming to the groups. That often is a concern. People will call me up and will say, well, you know, I'm not Catholic. You know, I'm Jewish. Can I come to the group? Well, of course you can. Because our groups are not faith-based at all.
Another extraordinarily profound concept, because in a grief, people get much, much closer to each other if they are in a group. And even if they do not communicate, but they are part of the group.
Absolutely.
Even subconsciously. So have this even respect for humanity and spirituality. I found tremendously wise concept.
Groups are amazing. We do about 5,000 group sessions a year. It's staggering. Mm-hmm. When I
wow.
look at the statistics
Incredible.
At the end of the year, wow. I can't believe it. It's the numbers are so high. But combining the children and the adult groups, it's actually over 5,000 group sessions. There's something powerful being in a group with other people that have had a similar loss, yeah. relationship-wise. Even if one was through cancer, one was through cardiac disease, one kidney disease, a murder, if it's the relationship that counts. So when adult children who are, most of the children, the adult children in our groups are usually in their 30s and 40s, grieving the loss of a parent, they can identify with one another. The same issues come up for them. This is one of the reasons why we separated the spouse partner groups, because someone who's married 60 years has different issues than someone who's married or together for 10 years. The issues are different. Someone who's married 60 years, maybe this is the first time in 60 years that they're alone.
Yeah.
Maybe the first time in their life, because years ago, I lived with my mother and father until I got married, and then I moved into with my husband. I never lived on my own. Today's kids are very different. They live on their own. Everyone's living, you know, different relationships. So it's very different. You have a woman who's in her 70s or 80s. She's never lived alone. She's never been alone before. Chances are the kids are all out of the house now, her adult children, so she is alone. Very different issues from someone who's in their 30s that's left with young children or teenagers. Most likely, hopefully, at some point they will remarry, but that's not what they want to hear. So you can't put those populations together, which is why we do the face-to-face intake to say, mm-hmm. okay, this person's not going into the day group. This will go into the young spouse group or the evening group. It gives us that flexibility to be able to do that. And so people do relate to one another. I had years ago in one of my young spouse groups, a man whose wife had died of pancreatic cancer, leaving him with a four-year-old son. He only had this four-year-old. And it was around the time of Halloween. And he had no idea what to do for Halloween. And all the young mothers in this young spouse group went over and took him and his son. They all went shopping for Halloween costumes, and they kind of told him what to do. It was so, so mm-hmm. wonderful. Similarly, I've had men in my spouse group, my older spouse group, now wouldn't happen now because now we have, I guess, the technology in with our car. Clocks are all digital, but years ago we didn't have digital clocks in the cars, and none of the women knew how to change the clocks from daylight savings
yes.
time.
I still
and
don't.
He literally went to everyone, you know, the women in the group, to each of their cars, their husband's mm-hmm. car, to change the clocks for them. So mm-hmm. having separate, you really can relate then to the other people in your group. So even whether it's a spouse group, a sibling group, when siblings are the forgotten grievers.
Yeah.
Adults who lose a sibling, that's your whole identity. You know, my brother knew me more than before my husband knew me. So it is a tremendous loss that most people in society don't really grasp the importance of sibling loss. And if the parents are alive, then the support tends to go to the parents who've lost an adult child, understandably. But what happens to the sibling who's trying to maintain perhaps his parents and support them, but at the same time grieving a terrible loss? Mm-hmm. So being in a group with other adult siblings is so powerful.
Another thought, we're living in a, it's not a secret, and greatly emphasized materialistic society. It's a race for gaining and not enough time and feelings for losses. So you're providing this time, compassion, and just endless care for someone who did lose.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the director of bereavement services at Calvary Hospital here in New York City. I was actually just thinking about something that Lena said when we spoke with Stephanie Mastropaolo, the juxtaposition of life and death. I was thinking about that as you were just talking about the support, the way in which the people are supportive within the group, and there, I'm even seeing a similarity with even with life in its most primitive forms biologically, how it manages to live and survive in the harshest environments. It's unbelievable, unthinkable, that life, that the force of living can, to some extent, even overpower the force of death. As much as they are intertwined. Calvary works with Kingsborough Community College. Can you tell us about that collaboration?
Yes, for many years our summer camp was held upstate, which was beautiful. 350 acres in the woods on a lake. It was really lovely. However, as we expanded the program, especially the children's program in particular, when we expanded that program into Brooklyn, it's too difficult for the children from Brooklyn to come all the way upstate. It would have taken them 2 hours each way. And this is a day camp, so we go back and forth. And although our buses are very comfortable, they're the plush buses, not the school buses, they're very comfortable buses, that's a huge trip for children to make. And so we were able to partner with Kingsborough. Their campus is right on the water in Brooklyn. It is a beautiful campus, and in the summertime, when we're there in August, we do our camp the third week in August. The children their college students are not back at campus. Their program, because they have programs for children as well, their programs are finished, and they have given us the run of their campus, and they have just been unbelievable to work with. So we have worked with them. This summer is our third summer with them, and it has been an incredible experience because I have hired many of their instructors. So for example, last summer I bought 30 guitars, and not toys, but guitars, and hired their music instructor to teach the kids, those children that wanted to learn how to play the guitar. So we hired their piano instructor, their guitar instructor. We hired their yoga instructor, so we offered the kids yoga. We've also hired their pottery instructor, and the kids were doing, when I say kids, not just the little kids, the teens as well, were doing pottery. This year we're adding some new instructors, We're keeping the guitar instructor because I have 30 guitars that we bought last year. And it went over so well. The kids had such a good time with the guitars. This year we're adding jewelry making. Mm. So we take it, and we pay the instructors. We've hired them. But it's wonderful having them because they're used to working with the kids. This is brand new activities for the children who have such a wonderful opportunity to be able to do this. One of the great joys that the children love, which is amazing, is fishing. Many of our children have gone fishing with their fathers or their grandfathers, and fishing has been a big part of their childhood. And they don't have fishing instructors, but we've hired their graduate students to help us. They're not counselors, and they don't do the counseling. Mm-hmm. So any of the kids that want to do fishing, they and their counselors go on the pier, which is right over there, and the graduate students help the kids and the counselors fish. So we have all of this availability to us. We use their food services to serve our meals, which are like banquets. They really are. Mm. It is so sad to see the kids. I mentioned that they get backpacks and sweatshirts and T-shirts. By the end of the day, you can't lift these backpacks. They are so full of food that the kids kind of take fruit, what cookies, whatever snacks we have, the backpacks. So several years ago, I said, you know what? Let's just order extra and buy cases of these Ziploc disposable containers and send everything home with the kids so they don't have to sneak the food, although they still do. They sneak the snack foods, but this way, we know that any leftovers they have for dinner. And the guardians wait for the kids when the kids get off the buses, whether it's in Brooklyn or here, and they come with shopping bags because they know that they're going to have, dinner. They're going to have the containers for dinner that night, which is really wonderful. It's very gratifying. Makes me feel good.
But, honestly, I would say this is fantastic that they treasure food. Because children, in many occasions, just feel they take it for granted. And I personally feel it's not a question of being wealthy or poor. It's a question of waste. And the fact that they felt that food is so important and they used their own, so to speak, physical caring abilities. Yeah. I think it's fantastic.
A lot of our children live in homeless shelters as well as in foster care. More and more so over the years, we've seen a shift, which reminds me of something else I wanted to mention about the children and how their grief is different. Mm-hmm. When a child loses a parental figure, there's always major changes within that household. There's major changes in every household when a loved one dies. But children in particular, many of the children that live in this community come from single guardianship homes to begin with. So when they lose their guardian, they often are shipped to an aunt, a grandmother, if they're lucky enough to have family members that will take them. So the siblings are separated. The children go off to different places. So even if they stay in the Bronx, it's a new school, new friends, new church or synagogue, new community, many, many, many changes that these children undergo in addition to the loss. So over the years, I have seen a tremendous increase in our referrals from foster care. We've had several. As a matter of fact, I think we have three children, not the same family, three separate families between Bronx and Brooklyn, where the children were adopted or not adopted, they were in foster care, were going to be adopted, and one of the foster care parents died. So this is yet another loss. Here they were going to be adopted, and now their foster care parent has died. It is amazing. Several of the children we also see may have been put in foster care because their parent is incarcerated. Mm. So you're talking about children that come with many, many losses, significant losses that they're dealing with. It really is incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. And yet the resiliency that they have is so heartfelt. It really is. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Kids do so well in groups. They love groups. They're used to after-school, sports or, chorus or being in the band. So they're used to after-school activities. Mm-hmm. So they like being in groups. They find it very helpful being in groups, and it shows. It shows.
How did you come to Calvary yourself? How did your paths cross?
Okay, well, I have born and raised in the Bronx, mm-hmm. and so as a child, I always knew the name Calvary, although not this facility here. I knew the old Calvary, although I never had a loved one die at Calvary. We are not Catholic, and so that years ago, the thought of going into Calvary was not something that I was used to, but always knew the name. When my youngest child, I have five children. When my oldest child started, when my youngest child started kindergarten, I went back to school. So I did not go through college in the regular routine. I first did my baccalaureate when my youngest child started kindergarten. Took me 6 years to do my undergraduate, which was in nursing. I am a registered nurse. Mm. Then I did my master's in thanatology, as I said, the study of death and dying, and then my PhD. Back in the early 80s, I was working at a large cancer hospital here in Manhattan and was a head nurse and loved my work, loved what I was doing, but the job description really was more administrative and took me away from patients and families. In the 2005, I had been at that hospital for about 24 years, but in 2005, I was already an assistant attending grief therapist there, the only one of its kind. They closed the program. They closed the program because bereavement is really not part of their mission statement. And I was out of work for about 2 weeks and called up Calvary just to see if they had any kind of opening. And at that time, their director had left. So it was, they were looking for me. They knew me because I'd been in the field for a long time. Dr. Brescia was very excited to know that I was coming to Calvary. And it has been wonderful because Calvary has been so good to me. It's because it's part of their mission. Whatever I want to do, whatever ideas I have in bereavement, they're so welcoming, both for the children's program as well as the adult program. We're now looking to increase our exposure and go into Manhattan, where there is a need, especially for children's programs in Manhattan. Our groups are in downtown Brooklyn, which are convenient for some Manhattanites, but not for everyone, unless you're living in the Lower East Side and you're going over the Brooklyn Bridge. It's more of a challenge. So we're hoping at the end of this year to be able to offer bereavement programs for both children and adults in Manhattan. But it's been such a wonderful marriage because bereavement is such a part of Calvary. It's just enmeshed into their core concepts of non-abandonment. Mm-hmm. And so although we're open to the community and, you know, to anyone, they see this as part of our mission. So it's been a wonderful place to work. People often ask me, aren't you ready to retire? It's time already, you know? I love what I do, and they're so good to me here. And the programs are so, so life-affirming. They really are. You can't help but be amazed when you see not only the children and teens, but even the adult programs. The New York Times did an article, I think it's two summers ago, on the four summers ago, on our men's group, which is an incredible group, because men tend to not want to come to groups. We grieve in different ways. So we used to think of it being as a masculine style and a feminine style, but the research shows that that's not true. You can have women that grieve in a more masculine style and men that grieve in a more feminine style. So two colleagues of mine, Ken Doka and Terry Martin, about 7 years ago started doing research looking at different ways that people grieve, and they've come up with two terms, intuitive and instrumental grievers. An intuitive griever we tend to think of as women. These are the people that come to groups. They'll come, they'll sit, they'll cry, they're okay with their emotions, and they love groups. An instrumental griever is someone that's more cognitive. So we tend to think of them as more masculine. Although, as I said, women can grieve in an intuitive way or an instrumental way. So an example of an instrumental griever is someone that, when there's a death, they go into problem-solving mode. Okay, let's make airplane, you know, reservations for Aunt Mary. You go to the airport. You go to the funeral home. Do this, this, and this. They're the organizers. They're the ones that kind of problem solve. After the funeral, they're the ones that they need to do something with their grief. So they'll hammer something. The story that I often use when I teach is one of my colleagues was working with a family whose 17-year-old child had taken the car out, miserable, rainy, nasty day, went into a fence, killed herself instantly, a couple of blocks away from home. The day of the funeral, the father went out, bought lumber, had it dropped off at the house where she crashed into the fence, and started building the fence. And people came out of the house. They recognized who he was, although they were not friends, and said to him, "Mr. So-and-so, we have insurance. You don't have to fix the fence. We'll get the insurance company will fix the fence." And he looked at them and said, "You don't understand. This is the only thing I can fix." That's an instrumental griever. That's someone took a hammer and hammered in those nails. That's an instrumental griever. One of the women in my death of an adult child group came in last year and told us that her 50-year-old son was going cross-country back to their family home, and he was driving, and she didn't understand why he was driving and not flying there. You know, why are you driving? He, also an instrumental griever, is an artist, and he sculpted a stone for his brother. His brother had died. He sculpted a stone for his brother to put at the cemetery and couldn't put it on a plane, and so he was carrying it cross country in the car. That's an instrumental griever. So I tell you this because maybe 8 years ago, I had a spouse group, a day spouse group, that tends to have older spouses, people who are retired, not working. I had 8 men in the group and 2 women.
Wow.
First time in my whole life that I ever had so many men in a group. And no one knew each other. It just happened that way. It just happened. So at the end of several sessions, we were doing 6 weeks at a time, and after several months, the women were ready to kind of go on. The men wanted to stay together. So I said, okay, we'll have a men's group. There was enough to do men's group. We opened it up to other men. These were all individuals initially that had lost a spouse or a partner. So what happened was we started, it was almost like a book review. The name escapes me now, but there's a wonderful book written by a social worker and a psychologist. And if you want the information, I can get that to you, but I don't know it offhand. Who wrote a book almost like Sex After 60. Each chapter was an older couple and who had remarried after the loss of their spouse. So some of the chapters were heterosexual, some of the chapters were gay marriages, or not marriages, gay relationships at that time. But each one dealt with adults. So dealing with adult children, dealing with, you know, having sex the first time after 60 years with someone else, what is that like? So we took a chapter each session, and I Xeroxed it for them, and they read it, and then we had like a discussion group. So at the end of that book, which probably had about 12 chapters, I said, okay. They still weren't ready to leave. So I said, okay, we need to open this up. We can't just keep it spouses. So we turned it into a men's discussion group. Most of the people in the group have lost a spouse or a partner. But there are men who have lost their siblings, men who have lost their fathers. We have had men who have lost adult children as well. Such a powerful group that 4 years ago, the New York Times came and did a wonderful article where they interviewed them, the men in the group. It was incredible. And their picture was, it was in the science section of the Times. It was really quite exciting. The guys were so excited. The group has bonded so. It's an open group, so men can come in. But once they come in, they're hooked. They're hooked. Because men tend not to have friends. Men have acquaintances. They have golf buddies, people they go to the Yankee game with. But they don't have friends in the same way that women have friends, where they'll talk on the phone and share, cry. With men, it's different. So this group really serves a purpose for those individuals that want to come into a group. They tell you they don't want to discuss their loved ones. Every group goes, and I don't bring it up, by the way, I'm the only female in the group. I have offered to get a male to lead the group, but they tell me I'm one of the guys, which is very, very sweet. So they let me stay in the group, and we talk baseball. We're all avid, most of us are avid Yankee fans, although we let Mets fans in as well. But it's a way that the men have bonded, and yet over discussions, it all goes back to grief. And they start talking about their partners and their wives, even if it was 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. It just gravitates. But it's not a bereavement group per se. So someone new in their grief, I try to steer to one of the spouse groups. However, having said that, we've had men that come into the group with recent losses, and they want to go into the men's group. They hear about the men's group, and even though they know the men in the group may be further along in their grief, they want the men's group. So, yes. Interesting.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Really, really fascinating. It clearly is a science, but also an art. And
yes.
It's such a endlessly profound subject. The fact that you offer these services for free is truly wonderful. And I understand that Calvary has a relationship with the Newman's Own Foundation. And that's obviously an example of something that can profoundly help Calvary continue offering these services at no cost.
Let's have one more break for a word from one of our supporters, Calvary Hospital.
Dear Calvary Hospital, my dad was at the end of his life, suffering from pancreatic cancer. I knew there was only one place that could relieve his pain and ours as well, Calvary Hospital. His wish was to die at home, so it was Calvary Home Hospice that provided Dad with the quality of life he deserved, filled with exceptional comfort and warmth. He passed on with dignity and grace, and we were all there with him. A year later, my mom needed the same Calvary care, and once again, Calvary's expert home hospice staff was there for us. My parents gave me unqualified love their entire lives. There was no better way for me to return this love than with Calvary's care. Yours truly, Deborah DiGregorio.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital. Our world-renowned hospice program brings our expert end-of-life care right into your home. Call us at 718-518-2465.
You're listening to the Lena Live Radio Hour with Dr. Sherry Schachter as our guest. She directs Calvary Hospital's bereavement services. Let's return to this final segment devoted to one of our gracious supporters, Calvary Hospital.
Could you say something to an individual or an organization who potentially would wish to contribute something to Calvary and have the assurance that what they will contribute will so to speak, be put into contributing, doing the good works for the people?
Absolutely. We're so grateful for Newman's Own. However, there are many foundations. Ronald McDonald, for example. The Ronald McDonald House is one of our funders also. And
Corbell.
The Carvel Foundation. Many, many foundations have helped. We depend on those foundations because that's what allows us to continue the works that we do. The hospital is wonderful in that, in providing these services. CAMP, for example, we have a 2-to-1 ratio. So most of our counselors are Calvary staff. This is not vacation time for them. This is a paid work week for them when they come to camp.
And the camp is also
No charge.
Oh, really?
Camp is free, and last year cost almost $75,000 for the week. For the food, each year gets bigger and bigger and bigger. At some point, we need to think about having 2 weeks of camp and actually splitting the group. We're going to have, I'm trying to keep it at 100. I have a feeling we'll go over 100 this year. Mm-hmm. Clearly, once we start in Manhattan, we will definitely go over 100 for next year because with each more and more exposure, the camp gets bigger and bigger.
Probably being an optimistic side, the bigger you go with all these offerings you have, you will have more of a support, more of a desire for people to give and to
Absolutely.
Share. Because it's such an unbeatable cause.
It is. It's very compelling. I often, not joke, but often say, the kids' stories really tug at your hearts. So people and foundations tend to give to the children's program, not to the adult program, which is interesting. The adult program isn't as costly as the children's program because camp is a huge cost. But there certainly are expenses that go with the adult programs as well. Mm-hmm. We serve food at all of our groups, not only at camp. That's the Jewish mother in me. Have to serve food. I think that really brings people together in groups. So all of our groups, whether it's the kids, the teens, or the adults, we have food. So that it's an expense both for children as well as adults. It's difficult when you live in a community that really doesn't have the resources to donate to camp. And so that's why we rely on foundations and the goodness of other people that do have the means. Clearly, all of the money that comes in is earmarked specifically for programs. And it allows us to keep innovative programs and to stay with the research. We will be doing a research study that I'm involved in, not so much for children, more on the for adults, but looking at bereavement and looking at indicators for what we call prolonged grief disorder, or what used to be called complicated grief or abnormal grief. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other, that could be a whole other session. but so we look to do research as well as fund different programs. I guess it was last year, we noticed a need coming out of our teen group that several of the teens had been engaged in self-injurious behaviors as a result of their bereavement.
Cutting themselves, usually in a thigh,
sometimes the belly area, areas that you don't see, mm-hmm. not so much on the wrist. This is not done as a suicide attempt. This mm-hmm. is done because they have so much emotional pain, they would rather feel the physical pain than the emotional pain. Mm. And self-injurious behaviors have been around forever. Yeah. This is not new. But we have seen an increase in that. And we started tying that together with bereavement. There's nothing written about bereavement and self-injurious behaviors. There's information about depression and self-injurious behavior, or personality disorder and self-injurious behavior in the psychological literature, but not necessarily bereavement. Mm-hmm. We went asking colleagues of ours what they did in their groups when they noticed a problem. No one was touching this subject. No one was like, oh no, we don't talk about it. We don't discuss it. We don't do anything. I was like, no, that's not going to work. We need to discuss this. So we developed a program, my kids' counselors and myself, of what they could do in group to talk about it, to open up the conversation, which my teen counselor did. When she did that in the group, and then they were doing expressive arts and came up with paintings that were just unbelievably graphic, we found that some of the individuals had started cutting years before with an initial death that they had when they were 8 years old. Mm. So then I said, well, now we have to discuss it with the little kids. We can't just ignore this. Developed a program, discussed it with the little kids, and sure enough, there were some of them that had either thought about cutting or had actually been engaged. So after we did those two sessions, we had a meeting with all the guardians specifically on cutting, not with the kids, not giving them any information that their child or not disclosing any confidentiality, but being able to talk about warning signs, what to look for, how to engage their child, their teens, or young children in the conversation. And that led to a series of workshops. So we're constantly looking for new programs, ways to embrace the community, and that can really only be done with the help of foundations that allow us the opportunity to hire more staff, to be able to hire perhaps an expert in one particular type of research that we might do. I talked earlier about the importance of parenting, and that good parenting skills will impact the way a child grieves. So a colleague of mine has done a lot of research, starting with divorced children, but then looking at bereaved children and seeing the way that good parenting helps them, helps the child cope with their loss. It's a study I would like to replicate. But to replicate that research study would involve hiring a statistician, hiring another counselor to actually do this. We need to, I'm not familiar with the technology, but we need to videotape all of those sessions that we do with the counseling sessions, because then that gets critiqued by a psychologist, the one who's doing the research, the initial research. So that would be funding that we need. That's not something that I can say, okay, we're going to take a couple of $1,000 and do this. It's going to be more than that. But that's kind of on my wish list in the future, to be able to replicate one of the studies, especially within our community here.
Extremely important information, and whether one is in a position to contribute something or is considering Calvary Hospital for their family needs, what they can certainly get from what we're conveying with our program is the extraordinary satisfaction with which the Calvary staff has in doing their job, and it's just absolutely extraordinary to listen and to for us to absorb all of this, and extremely important for our listeners also to get possibly the most important catalyst in their decision, regardless of where they are in their decision, but to hear. For them to hear that people who are working at Calvary so passionately love their job is invaluable. We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services at Calvary Hospital here in New York City. And I think we have covered it all, with the exception of one last question.
Okay.
And it's always my favorite question to ask, unless if you would like to ask something else.
No, actually, I'm going to welcome your last question, because it was a very lengthy conversation, and it was actually more comprehensive and deeper than we expected, but I cannot imagine any of a lesser degree with your expertise, with your intuition, which we talked about, and certainly tremendous resourcefulness. You mentioned that there are some other issues which deserves in its own conversation, which I hope I call it the sunshine help, because you're always opening certain doors. So obviously I do not want to touch certain issues which are so relevant, and they merged, just to mention one, how much potentially crime you cut by your service, especially if the summertime, how much relieve some psychiatric disorder in the future. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of social issues which should inspire people to donate, to give, to share from their foundation, and just hearing that sound becomes bigger and bigger. So I just wanted to firstly to congratulate you, because to be a mother of five, probably
and grandmother of eight.
Really?
My God. Grandmother of eight. You can have your own family program and have it as a model. Needless to say, wife. And such a tremendous humanitarian, and with your professionalism, and it's a tremendous pleasure to meet you. And as I said, this is just a huge seed, but it's still a seed in the ground. So With that, I will give you opportunity to ask your last question.
This is more of an old Russian tradition in the course of dialogue, usually during interviews, but not necessarily. It started more in the university academic setting, where a question which is may seem unrelated to the topic at hand, but in fact is very profoundly related in the end. And the question is this: what event in your childhood or during your formative years occurred and had such a profound impact that it continues to influence who you are today and what you do today?
That's actually a very easy question to ask, because it has driven me all these years. I was raised, as I said, in the Bronx, and my family of origin, my parents, were probably not the role model of good parenting. I will leave it at that. And my grandmother lived with us. And I learned very early not to be afraid of death, because there are things worse than death. And I truly believe that. I'm not afraid of death. I've never been afraid of death. There are things like abuse worse than death. And so, raised by my grandmother, who I absolutely adored, was a foundation for me. I had a brother. He died a few years ago. My brother was 5 years older than me. My sister, 10 years older than me. My sister escaped the house when she was 17, so we were never really close, although we are close now as adults. But my brother was only 5 years older than me, and he was my big protector. And my brother, I hung around with him all the time. When I was 8 years old, I met my brother's best friend, and I married him. And so we're actually married 53 years, going on 53 years. But his family, my husband's family, were a very loving, stable family. My mother-in-law and father-in-law, we lived in the neighborhood, we all grew up in the Bronx, were very, very loving, open, generous. And so from the time I was 8 years old, I was always with them. And they, because my grandmother had since died, those three were really the grounding for me in doing the work that I do. So I hope that answers your question.
Perfectly. That's remarkable.
We were listening to Dr. Sherry Schachter, the Director of Bereavement Services at Calvary Hospital in New York City, one of the gracious supporters of our program. To our listeners from all around the world, we say thank you for joining us. And please come back to us next Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Lena Live Radio Hour. Until then.